Dr. Bredsdorf, reel 7.
But of course, in German uniform, he was a German officer and loyal to the Germans. He just happened to speak Danish because he was born in that part of the country. And it was then arranged that our little friend who had the contact should fetch this man somewhere in a place they had decided on, and then take him through an open park where we had put armed members of resistance behind some bushes so that they should take action in case the little Dane from pre-Denmark, was not alone with the man or was held up by him with a revolver, or whether it was clear that he was under pressure of some kind. And then they should act. But if it seemed to be normal, then they should walk through the whole of the park to a certain place in Copenhagen where a taxi would be waiting. And the taxi driver was one of our men. And he was the one who knew that inside a certain cemetery in Copenhagen, I would be standing there. But the man didn't know it himself, so he should take him there, and I should meet him there. He should meet me there. But my orders were to hear what he had to say, what his suggestion was, and tell him that I'm not in a position to say yes or no to anything, but I'm in a position to go back to the Freedom Council and get their answer to it, but I cannot negotiate. I can take your message across. And then the great anticlimax came because the taxi driver arrived and the man, the German officer, wasn't there and had never been there. And what had happened was that the Danish military intelligence had heard of this story, and although they had promised to respect the decisions of the Freedom Council, they had thought, this is for us to negotiate. It's not for the Freedom Council. So they had taken the man to negotiate with them, and he, of course, was happy not to have to wait any longer. So, and there was a protest from the Freedom Council to the military espionage. So you've broken your promise. This was arranged that he should meet our representative, and you have broken in and taken him away. Nothing much came out of it, but I was in that position that I was chosen to negotiate with an official representative of the German General Lindemann, head of the German forces in Denmark. And this was on September, not September, of course, in the spring. It's on the, in the middle of April, 45. So it was the meeting which was due on the 17th or 18th of April did not take place. And Montfort, in his diary, reported the whole thing and reported that the meeting did not take place because one of the military people declared they had mandate from the council to undertake this sort of negotiation, which they didn't. But now we were nearing so much the end of the period that it was clear that it was only a matter of short time. and there was Mons Faux was the leading person in the negotiations on part of the resistance movement, and I followed it closely because I was in daily contact with him. To begin with, the old political leaders insisted that if the German, when the German capitulation took place, it was people who had been elected by Danish parliament who should take over, a legal Danish government, let's say the old politicians. And the resistance movement insisted that it was impossible and that the Danes would never allow the government in which the resistance movement was not represented. And in the end, the solution was 50-50. 50% representatives of the resistance movement and 50% of the old guard, with a man, a social democrat, who represented the old politicians as prime minister, but otherwise 50-50. An unsatisfactory decision, in fact, but the only possible compromise, I suppose.
Could I ask you about the summer of 1940, after the fall of France and the Low Countries, when it looked as though Hitler had conquered the whole of Europe and that he'd really won the war? Did you think then that the war was finished and that Denmark was going to be under permanent German occupation?
Perhaps I'm deceiving myself when I say that never at any time did I believe that this would last forever, that the German occupation would last forever. Maybe I'm deceiving myself, but that is, to the best of my recollection, true, that I didn't put a period on it, but I thought that it must end. Of course, the resistance movement grew much stronger after Stalingrad, because then people could see that it was possible to defeat the Germans, and many who had believed that it was impossible could see it now. And I don't know whether it's self-deceit when I said that I never believed it, but at least I went into the resistance movement at a time before Stalingrad, and when I still realized that I'm here and I'll have to stay here as long as it lasts, or as long and until I'm arrested. And I was in the luckiest position that I was never taken. I was never arrested. I could have been, and I feared it very much. I was very, very much afraid of being arrested because I knew that it meant torture. And the idea of torture was so abhorrent to me that, and of course I don't know, I can't say how long I could have lasted. Nobody knows that. I mean, I could have hoped that I could have lasted at least 24 hours before I began to say, to reveal things. But on the other hand, it was a silent agreement among us that you should keep quiet as long as possible, but at least 24 hours, so that others knew that you didn't, somebody knew that you didn't turn up at an appointment, and therefore you must have been caught, and that would mean that a lot of people would have to move to other addresses. Whether I could have kept it for long enough, and I mean revealing things means revealing what is most obvious, giving the names of people who are already on the ground. But I mean, if you begin to open up the whole bag, then it's disastrous. And I don't know. Nobody knows himself. I hope that I could have lasted longer.
You were telling me earlier off the record that you felt you were able to make some kind of judgment about the kind of personalities who would resist or who would inform or who would collaborate. Mm-hmm. Can you analyze that and separate out the criteria which you could judge people by?
Yes, there's one group of people. This was in England after I came to England after the war, when it was still sort of very much in my mind. I knew how people had acted and so on. And there were people who were traditionally so overcautious that they would not, I mean, if Britain had been occupied, I'm sure they would not have taken up the fight. They would not have been pro-Nazis. But if there had been a similar situation as we had, where the king and the government and parliament said, don't have anything to do with these terrible people. They are doing damage to Denmark. Be loyal to the authorities and behave properly. And they didn't say love the Germans, but show respect to the situation and behave in an orderly way. And there were many people who thought that's the way they would have done. And then there was a minority, which I'm sure exists in every country, where I thought, here I met somebody who would have seen at an early stage, I can profit from that. I can do a deal, especially if I believe that this is going to last, as many did at the beginning of the war. I can do a deal. I can earn money, good money, by going the right way. Not necessarily by being collaborators in the political sense, being ready to be actors, informers. That's a different category, and I couldn't recognize it. You don't know these people until you meet them in actual life. But who said, well, other people can earn money, why should I not do it?
The venal type.
Yes. And then thirdly, the group where I said, these are people with courage. They would not submit. They would be prepared as soon as they saw a chance to cooperate against the enemy. I mean, it's your guesswork, and I may be wrong about most of them, but I don't think I am. I was at that time. Of course, I came so freshly from a country where that I had seen people in all three categories. But the third category, the fourth category of real nasty informers and sadists who simply, I mean, were willing to cooperate with the Gestapo because it gave them a chance of whipping people, torturing them, and that satisfied them. You don't know them, of course, in advance. They are there in every country, a small group, and they are being used.
People who take pleasure in the suffering of others?
Yes.
What happened to you on Liberation Day?
I had promised already long in advance, although I could go back to my job, of course. But I didn't. I had promised to take leave of absence from my job and to continue as editor of the now legal weekly paper for Denmark, which was established and had the reputation now of being the official paper of the underground. So there was a legal for Denmark continuing the one which was started in April 43 and which now began in May 45 and continued. And I was together with another person who'd also been on the editorial board, and she was a journalist. She'd been arrested by the Gestapo for her share in Free Denmark. She'd been sent to a camp in Denmark, but she was among the 10 persons we got free through the German officer Hermansen. And she was ready now, so she and I were the editors with an editorial board behind us, including Christus Møller, who now came back from England and became Minister of Foreign Affairs in Denmark. And Mogens Fog became minister also, and others. And they were still on the editorial board of the new paper, and I remained there as editor, co-editor.
By sheer coincidence, we happen to be conducting this interview on the 50th anniversary of D-Day. What are your memories of, personal memories of receiving the news of D-Day?
Joy, jubilation. I mean, we had waited for that so long. And it came, it came as a surprise to Hitler. And came as a surprise to me, but I mean, the day came as a surprise, that it was that day, but I expected it for sooner or later, so did Hitler. And Hitler thought it would take place in another place near Calais. But of course, that made the end of the war nearer, and therefore it was very important. And in the resistance, we admired the British, we admired Britain, and I had feelings about Churchill, Winston Churchill, and Montgomery, which I don't have today. But they were heroes at that time, because they won the war. We didn't win the war. We were very happy that they recognized us as allied because of the resistance movement. But it was, I mean, we couldn't win a war. We could help in our small way in pushing it the right way internally. And when people say afterwards that, for instance, a sabotage didn't worry the Germans very much. So maybe that's right, but it did worry them because it did do damage to their transport of troops to Norway, and it any little sting that gave them was helpful, and that was as much as we could do.
Were you in Jutland when the news of D-Day came?
Yes. I was in Jutland that time.